Lord Vader, Operation Andor is underway.
Excellent. If we release 3 episodes per week, the Lorehounds will never be able to cover every episode. The Imperial forces will crush the rebellion before it begins.
Stand by. We're picking up something on our scanners.
Echo Squadron, reporting in.
Delta Squadron, on your left.
Django Squadron, on your 6.
With Imperial forces coming in fast, we're calling all Rebels to join the fight this season. Starting after the April 22nd premiere, you'll hear 3 full breakdowns for each week's episodes of Andor Season 2. Each podcast will be led by one of our squadron leaders, Alicia, David, and John. We'll be bringing in new and familiar voices to fill out the roster. Search for the Lorehounds on any podcast platform to join us in a galaxy far, far away. And don't forget to check out our season pass for even more content like our Holocron bonus pods. It's good news for anyone, except Darth Vader. Podcast. We're the Lorehounds, your guides to the political intrigues of feudal Japan. I'm John.
And I'm Alicia, and this is our coverage for episode 10, A Dream of a Dream, of the FX limited series Shogun.
Today we'll start off with our hot takes on the episode, and then we've got a couple of historical notes, after which we'll get into a full discussion of plot and character, along with our favorite moments. We're going to save up all our listener feedback for the next podcast, which will be a season wrap-up.
So please do send us feedback, as we'd love to hear your thoughts and reactions. Send it to shogun@thelorehounds.com or head to the contact page on the website and use the form or record us a voicemail that we can drop right into the podcast. It's your last chance to write in about Shogun, so please get in your feedback ASAP.
Support the community on Supercast or Patreon. Join the conversation on Discord and take a listen to our affiliate podcasts. There's links for everything in the show notes, and we'll talk more about it in the outro. So, Alicia, you're here, but I think we have another special guest with us for a few minutes.
Is there someone else lurking on this call?
You know, I may be podcasting from the inside of my car from another stage, and I may be dealing with the effects of a long COVID recovery, but my skills are sharper than ever. So don't leave my body in a yard to fill the bellies of dogs.
Would you rather be eaten by fish?
I think that might be an interesting experience, you know, because you're floating in the water and, you know,
it could sounds be, it slow could be fun. And painful.
You just kind of bleed out. Well, it's getting, we're starting the podcast off on a dark tone.
Okay.
Well, I mean, I think suits the series.
Okay.
It's true.
Well, David's John, recording from his phone, so please excuse his audio quality, but he'll be back on full swing for the season wrap-up if you want to hear all his takes. Hot takes, everyone.
Yeah, John, what did you think of this finale episode?
I shared a preview of my thoughts on the Discord channel last night. Under hot takes, I just wrote, fucking masterpiece.
Yeah.
It subverted my expectations in the best way. And that phrase triggers me after Game of Thrones. But it's just the best way to describe what the showrunners did. I mean, they created a situation where we were all expecting for the last 2 episodes, one of them having this huge battle and Toradaga is going to come out on top. This, you know, victor covered in blood and just ruling over everyone. And instead he's like, no, I already won without ever striking a blow. And that was an incredible moment. I mean, we're 15 minutes to the end, and I look at the time remaining, and I'm like, how are they going to wrap this up? Turns out we don't need to wrap it up because Toranaga's already wrapped it up in the future.
Right. Crimson Rain has already fallen.
Yep. And Crimson Sky was the Mariko we made along the way.
What did you think? What did you think, David?
I was pretty impressed with this show. I don't want to get into my season thoughts, but the way that they brought this episode to a close was so confident and so clear-eyed. I was just enraptured with it. I was kind of transported while watching this, and one of the big thoughts that I had was this ending was so consistent with Torunaga character and what his motives were. The whole time he was trying to avoid a war, a mass war. Sure, he'll sacrifice a few, you know, best friends and trusted vassals, but in the balance, it's kind of a trolley style problem, where yeah, he'll sacrifice a few so that they're to avoid this large scale war. And I think, you know, a couple of episodes ago, they set that up with him as the young warlord, that lesson really went to heart for him. And so to be able to tell that story and to tell that that core motivation of Torunaga in such a quiet and subtle and just very, I don't want to say ethereal, there were some ethereal parts to this, but mm-hmm. it just had this transportive element where I just felt like I was floating along the whole episode. And to be able to do that with an episode of television is an incredible feat. So hats off to the creators. And yeah, I was expecting, I was really, you know, oh, are we going to get some nice good fight stuff? And in some ways I'm more satisfied than with that. I think that they were very smart in how they played this out.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I was hit super hard by this episode that it put me in a dark place for the rest of the day, I have to be honest. And I was almost like not mad at it, but just like, oh man, I don't need help accessing, you know, these emotions of despair and sadness. But I think that it is a fucking masterpiece. It was a perfect emotional punch, just the way they tied everything together and they gave each character the most appropriate fate. It's a cynical show, but it was always a cynical story. And yeah, I had to compose a tanka, which is, you know, it's not a haiku. it's like a haiku in that it's measured by syllables, but it's not, instead of the 575, it's 57577. So, okay. This is my tanka for Mariko.
Ooh.
My heart is heavy, spongy, soft, and sopping blood. The maggots nibble, but there's no blackthorn feasting, just a bonfire of her words.
I think Yabushige would be very proud of you. That was awesome.
No, Yabushige would find a reason to nitpick it. Mariko would
He'd be proud of you. It was characters and scenes and stories that I will remember for the rest of my life.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely my show of the year so far.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to beat in terms of quality. Although, you know, there are other happier shows that maybe I walked away with more of a spring in my step.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's batting a 10 for me for sure. I just don't know if it's going to go to an 11, which is a game changer. Like, has it changed the state of the industry?
No, it's in terms of a, I'm just gonna tell you, you're wrong.
You think right? I know. Well, okay, fine. You think it's an 11.
I'm at a 10. 9.
Wow, a 9. Okay.
I mean, it's just there's little things, like I know the language thing, the European language thing, bothers me more than anyone else. That's fine. We all have our.
You're saying the fact that they don't have anybody speaking Portuguese.
Well, yeah, just the fact that they treat all European languages like they sound the same. And I guess that's, you know, sort of a nice reverse, just in general, the way that Westerners are treated in the show, as mm-hmm. is appropriate. It's from a Japanese perspective and they're outsiders and maybe we all sound the same. But it just made certain scenes more confusing than they need to be. And I don't know. They're just little things like that that I nitpick. But I think that this is still one of the greatest shows ever created.
Quick shout out to another podcast, Alicia. I didn't post this in the Discord yet, but there was a good interview with the showrunners on the Watch podcast. Chris and Andy interview the showrunners, and there's a bunch of conversation about how they went through the translation process and actually how they resolved all of a lot of those questions and issues. And so it was really interesting to get that feedback of they translated, and then they were like, then the production folks on the Japan side were like, oh, this is good, but it's not great. So then they went to the whole other thing, and then the actors added stuff. It was a really, at least on that side of the equation, it was a apparently an extraordinarily well-crafted production in terms of making sure that the language was right. So,
yeah, there's been good coverage also on the Prestige TV feed also.
Yes.
Our favorite ringer.
Well, I think that's enough hot takes. I think let's move into some historical context. So I didn't actually put this in the outline, but I just wanted to discuss a little bit about what happens next. And if you want a more full discussion of this, the show's official podcast does a good job of outlining everything. But this is a real thing that happened. I mean, not exactly in every detail, but this idea of the Tokugawa shogunate, which is the real world version of Torinaga, just takes over Japan basically and sets up the longest standing shogunate in Japan. It begins the Edo period. Edo, of course, becomes Tokyo eventually, and it lasts from 1603 to 1868. So past the U.S. Civil War, Torinaga is still, you know, ruling through his ancestors. And it's super impressive. It has its ups and downs because it is a very peaceful era. It's also very isolationist. I think the show did a good job of showing why the Tokugawa shogunate would be a little bit isolationist and a little bit wary of foreigners, especially after being taken advantage of by the Portuguese and probably later the Dutch and English. But it was like kind of a Japanese Renaissance where they're having, you know, all these arts and cultural advancements. We saw Torinaga starting to set up Edo, right, with this is the official sex work district. This is the official church area right next to the sex work district.
But one thing they didn't talk about is that, you know, they made it Japan very isolationist. So they weren't so taken advantage of after that. And that kind of allowed this to thrive.
Fair enough. But yeah, I mean, this was a real fundamental shift in Japanese politics. And the emperor basically, I know they were saying on the official podcast, the emperor was basically a figurehead during this period. And the Tokugawa shogunate really just ruled everything.
Yeah, I think that it's, I don't want them to do a sequel series to this. You know, no. I think that this is perfect.
Well, they already have one. It's Blue Eyed Samurai.
Okay, fair enough. I am going to watch that finally next. But I would love if they did similar to the James Clavell novels, which, again, I have not read. But I know that they are each focused on different characters in different periods and places. And I would love if this same crew with this same historical attention to detail came back and did more stories like this in other parts of Japanese or wider, broader Asian history.
That would be very cool. An anthology series would be great. Even if they did it like American Horror Story and recast the same people every season, but as different characters, I'd be okay with that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think this production lasted something along the lines of 5+ years for them to work on it. Obviously, there was a COVID curveball in there. But I agree with the point in that built a process and a knowledge base, and they found actors and production companies and translator companies and weapons masters and set deck and all of this kind of stuff, that they've built an incredible resource for being able to create this high level prestige drama. I would certainly be in favor of that if they were willing to dedicate another, you know, 3, 4, 5 years of their lives to producing something on this scale.
It's literally their job. So
yeah. It is. Yeah. It really is.
Well, I guess the biggest problem with it is one of the biggest reasons this show stands out is the authenticity to historical customs and historical, you know, costuming and language and whatnot.
Even props.
And And every time you change periods, you got to redo everything from scratch almost.
That's true.
And so sure. I think it would still be a 5-year process to do another season.
Well, but without the COVID curveball, as David put it, I think 3 years seems. Well, yeah, but then they Alicia's have to like, completely I'll give break you three. It down. I've just set a reminder. I'll be checking back in.
we need to get you a job over at FX, you know.
Yeah. I was listening to the official podcast. I only started the episode 9 listening to the official podcast, but they had a really moving interview with Clavel's daughter, actually, who I guess was an executive producer on the show or some kind of producer. And she had said, she praised the show and she said, you know, basically my dad was focused on the characters and storytelling. He was an entertainer first. But what FX added was the authenticity and the truth to history. And that really made it come alive.
And my favorite thing from that interview is where she said where they scatter the ashes with Fuji at the end is apparently where her own father's ashes are scattered in real life in that lake.
Wow. Wow. That's cool. That's a cool detail. I haven't listened to that one yet.
Yeah.
That's lovely.
All right. Why don't we get into the full episode now? So I just wanted to bring back a theme that we've been discussing throughout the season, fate, right? And this comes up a bunch during this episode because you have Torunaga talking about Blackthorn, saying it's not his fate to leave Japan. But isn't that just because Torunaga stranded him there, marooned him? I mean, it's so interesting to talk about fate in the context of like, who is making fate, right? And then you have a similar thing where Yabushige says to him, what is it like to shape the wind to your will? And he's like, I don't shape the wind, I just study it. But is that even true?
Right. I mean, I think that was my favorite quote of the entire episode, because I do think it is very true that the people who they're like, oh, you're pulling the puppet strings. Like, no, we're just studying how the way the wind blows. The wind is a great analogy because it is something you cannot control. You cannot control the things in life like your son slipping on a rock and dying.
Right.
But you can study these things so you know how to respond, how to adapt, and how to dance in the wind, so to speak.
But Torunaga does sort of control the wind for other people, right? He's at least blowing fans in different directions. I mean,
he's got wind funnels set up.
It's true. It's true. I mean, like, destroying Blackthorn's ship, preventing him from returning to England, is him shaping Blackthorn's wind, at least. It's really interesting to consider that. But I think you're right. That's a really good point, that Torunaga really is a master improviser, and he's sort of windsurfing, right? And the way that I think, you know, Torunaga at the beginning of the series is thinking, and even in the flashback to the Taiko's death, he's thinking, all right, now's not the time. Now it would be a revolt, but people are going to get really tired of disorder, and I'm going to be there to bring them some order.
I mean, and he's so Machiavellian, but better him than other leaderships that we see maybe in the present world. Anyway,
I think it brings in an interesting as well as to how I don't know that he hoped that Lady Ochiba would come around in some way. And so when he gets that letter from her, there's that flood of release of emotion on his face, present on his face, that the hope that he had hoped for has come through. And it is, I think it is a really good analogy, the windsurfing thing, which is I can put myself in this position and only hope. And if the wind blows the right way, then maybe I can catch this wave or whatever. Right. And when he does catch that wave of Lady Ochiba coming around, it's such a powerful thing because he now knows that he can avoid this war, that all of these deaths that he's had to live through, connive to position people to die these ways, it means something, and those deaths are not in vain, which I also think makes a really interesting commentary on his character. We've all been rooting for Torunaga. He's been set up as sort of a good guy for us, but you know, he is also not above ordering the deaths of some villagers to trick Blackthorn into having a moral crisis moment to see which way he's going to land. So, you know, he's a complex character. And I think that's another thing I love about the show is that there's no simple black or white good guy, bad guy. Torunaga is as much of a gaslighter and a manipulator as anybody. Yeah.
He can absolutely be really cruel. And that is such an interesting character that we're rooting for. It reminds me of Jamie Lannister, right? It's like we start rooting for him because he makes a turnaround. Torunaga's almost the opposite, is he starts doing shadier stuff as the series goes on.
As he gets more and more boxed into positions, he's got to sacrifice bigger and bigger pieces to be able to get it done. But then he has that ultimate objective, which is to create a stable and peaceful Japan that can flourish over a couple of hundred years. Right.
Yep.
That's an incredible legacy. But it's the brutality of the moment and the brutality of the as much as there is a culture of beauty and life and subtlety, it's also a place where, loyalty and honor play these huge roles, and that sets up these conflicts so that when Blackthorn has his moment of crisis, is it hope or is it faith? You know, when Muraji translates for him there, it's a really powerful moment. And so when you compare that to Torunaga's moment of when he has faith and hope that Uchiba is going to come around, it really does affect him. And Hironada Sanada really shows us that in his portrayal and in the character of Torunaga, the subtle facial emotions of him, like almost breaking out in tears,
right?
Because he's so happy and relieved.
You know what I love about this series is that, you know, people complain it didn't end with a big battle. We got a hint of it, of course, but I think that this is showing, we're so used to historical epics like Braveheart and such, you know, the sacrifices that are made on the battlefield. And this show shows you that it's all a battlefield, you know, the entire political landscape. And this is about the sacrifices made on that battlefield, you know.
Yeah.
Mariko, yeah. Hiramatsu, all of them.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it's just because it's not at scale doesn't mean it doesn't have impact.
Right, because these are important people that we're still talking about centuries later.
Yeah. I think the case of Mariko, even her, like, they use some of her real poetry in this.
I
believe and the effect that she had and her death had. And the point was made on another podcast. They were like, here we are hundreds of years later talking about her and her effect and her impact of her words.
Right.
You know, the bonfire that she's made.
Yeah.
You know?
Hosokawa Gracia really had a real impact in the real world.
Absolutely. Yeah. Apparently there are still communities that revere her in an almost saint-like way.
Do you know, though, that apparently Adams, the real life Blackthorn, never met the real life Mariko? Like, that was a total fiction. Never even met her.
Oh, well.
Did real life Blackthorn make it back to Europe?
No, he stayed in Japan.
Home? Yeah, he did stay in Japan.
Left. Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So it's another nice little historical parallel there. That was another thing in this episode. There were a lot of little rhyming couplets. We talked a lot about that during True Detective, a show I know John just loves. It's going to rank high in his list.
Yeah.
But there's a lot of little rhyming couplets, like when Torunaga is in having the audience with Yabushige, right? That was the same place where Blackthorn was first brought before. I believe it was Omi. No, Yabushige was there, so it was sort of reversed. Or when Blackthorn presents his weapons to Omi. So there's a lot of little parallels and echoes throughout the whole thing. So I like that I saw in the outline that you had put a mention of the dream sequence. I don't know if we should talk about that now or if you want to kick that
later. Let's go into it right away. You know, the dream of a dream. I kind of wanted to be like, did we like this? Because this was probably the most controversial part of the whole season.
I was a little confused at first, but on my second watch, I really got what it did and how it functioned. And I liked the fact that we see the cross in his hand, never mind his grandchildren. You know, they're like, oh, these are little whatever.
These savages.
The cross in his hand, it set me up the first time I watched it to go, oh, okay, he survives. He carries his love for Mariko with him. You know, he's obviously prospered and has had family. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, back in Europe, and so it set me up to be thinking that, oh, he's going to make it through, and all this other stuff is going to happen. And then when he's out on the water with Fuji and he lets the cross go, it was a big surprise for me. Mm-hmm. Because I was like, oh, but in the dream, right? That's mm-hmm. a foreshadowing, right? That's a jump to the future. And then I realized how they set up the dream. That was just when he was concussed and unconscious. But that moment when he lets the cross go is, for me, more poignant because they had falsely led me to this conclusion that
right.
he kept it and he lived. And so then when that moment happens, it's not just a pap sappy moment, but it's actually a very profound and unexpected, because I had a different expectation. They subverted the language of television on me, like, oh, look, here's the foreshadowing, you know, and he survives. And it's like, nope, that's not what actually happens. And so the first watching, I was confused by it. The second watching, I loved it. And I thought it was a perfect device.
Yeah. And he's letting go of the crucifix, just like he lets go of his sort of European-based dreams and ambitions in the scene with Torunaga.
That's a good point.
Yeah, he says it's not his war. Yeah. I thought that was like the most depressing part of the episode until I realized that it was a dream, and you know, and it was like, oh, he's just going to stay in Japan being a clown for Torunaga and rebuilding his ship forever. I'm like, yeah, well, no, that's not a bad life, to be honest. It sounds way better at this point than going back to, as you have in the notes, a bratty racist grandchildren.
It seems like a good life until you realize Torunaga is going to break every ship. Oh, no. It's crazy. There's an earthquake every single time that you finish a ship. He had one plank left.
Earthquakes don't affect the water. I don't know. Japanese earthquakes are different.
So he does have bratty racist grandchildren in the dream of a dream. Right. And he does look full of regrets, right? Can I also just say, I thought that the makeup on him as an old man looked pretty bad. And I was like, but then when I found out it was a dream of a dream, I was like, okay, I guess that's just a young man's picture of himself as an old man.
He can't imagine his face changing. Yeah.
I will say that the way that they used this device, and like I mentioned, you know, subverting the language of television, you know, we had certain expectations. It really reminds me of what Noah Hawley does with Fargo, where they start out every episode with, this is a true story, the names have been changed. And it sets up this discordant thing in your mind that then when the plot plays out and the characters play out, you get surprise and you get delight and you get to, you're looking at the story and the characters from a different vantage point. So not only did the showrunners, you know, and all of the writers do just a beautiful job of illuminating all of these characters in this time period, but they were really smart about television. And they were really smart about how to produce this season. And we can talk about it more in the season end. But yeah, I just thought it was a really clever device and did something that was unexpected in the show. And I think it added to the overall excellence of this season finale to bring this to a complete and satisfying close. And I think that device does play some significant role in landing the final episode.
Speaking of closing, I guess the polls are closing on whether to go to war with Torunaga, and the council's meeting, Ishido is clearly clinging to power, and he has to stop everyone from taking a revote after an earthquake omen. Ochiba already very doubtful here. Can I also add on Ochiba? The book makes very clear why she distrusts Torunaga, but the show never addresses it. I wonder why that is.
So they said, where was it? Maybe it was in the Prestige TV interview pod, but the writers were saying that they actually, I think they filmed some stuff more related to the book, where basically it's about her kind of being in love with Torunaga, and having also he knows her secret about having had you know, the baby is not the Taiko's real son, and that's why she had to like get rid of him or something. But I like the way that they just left, they made it more tied to her father, because that feels more visceral to us as an audience.
Yeah, I hear that. I mean, I think that it's a really direct, a really direct slight that she perceives, that in the book that Torunaga saw her, she thinks that Torunaga saw her having an affair the day that the heir was conceived, basically. And she's gaslit herself into believing that that's the Taiko's true son. But she's like, Torunaga knows that there's something up with this.
I think in another, in the hands of other showrunners or another network, there would have been a lot more playing around with these motivations. This could have been a three-season television show. And so it really takes an act of courage and to constrain and to remove that kind of material from being on screen. And in some ways, been too obtuse or too sort of gross to go into the whole legitimacy of the heir, and did she, you know, find some farmer who looked the same part, and what? I think it just by removing it, it actually highlights it, and it actually makes us want to dig more into the motivations and the characters, and it's more enticing to not have that material just sort of, you know, obviously open and discussed about in the show and the characters and the writing. It gives it a bit more mystery and a bit more nuance. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, as I'm currently working on our show guide for House of the Dragon and trying to keep track of who had affairs with who and who's an illegitimate child. By the way, I wouldn't use that term in real life, but we're talking about Game of Thrones here. But anyway...
Legitimacy in terms of the throne, who has legitimate claim.
Right. Yeah.
A recognized claim, yeah.
So anyway, it's just this Ochiba thing feels like it belongs in that universe more than this show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I agree. There's, you know, we've ourselves done plenty of comparing with the political machinations of Game of Thrones. And it's there. They're both just such rich, nuanced character studies that, you know, that's there to discuss, and that's a good basis for that. But yeah, this is definitely much less sensationalist, this story, especially the way that they've played it in this miniseries. And I really like that about it, that it's still incredible, memorable, crazy things happen, but it's all feels like it's inevitable in some way. It's comes from a natural human place.
Agreed.
Not exactly. Just for the sake of drama.
Exactly.
What do we think about Ishido being like, no, the Mariko's death was Torunaga's fault. He did it.
I wonder.
Desperation.
Yeah.
And I just wonder how much the rest of the regents are going, you know, they're playing along with the theater, but that, I mean, I guess, what's his name? I don't have the show guy in front of my head. The Kiyama. How much Kiyama says, you know, that a regent could have ordered that attack. I thought that was cutting pretty close to actually voice those words in the council meeting in that moment.
Right.
But I did like that they said, well, you know, it's the castle's not as safe as we were led to believe.
Yeah,
but I don't think that Saeki, or I believe it's Ido, is the other lord. I don't think any of them are courageous enough to stand up and actually challenge Ishido openly in this moment.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think Ishido just shows again, he does not understand the political nuance that's required to pull off what he's trying to pull off. And that's, he really needed Ochiba for that. But then, and I think that I know that that's a change that they made for this show to make Ochiba and Mariko close childhood friends. But that adds so much to the motivations here, and, you know, just shows You really need to understand personal relationships before you start trying to make moves around the chessboard.
Yep. And I think part of the story they were trying to tell us was Ishido did not grow up in, you know, playing the Game of Thrones. And so he didn't know how to navigate that.
Wasn't there a line he even says during that meeting that, oh, right, it was after the earthquake. And he says, we're not peasants here, you know, being frightened by.
And everyone else is like, eh.
So, and again, they were just playing with those subtleties where he even calls himself out there in that moment of, well, we're not all peasants here, but yes, you are a peasant. And so I don't know what that says in a larger conversation about a meritocracy and being able to rise to levels and what a class-based system, how they look down at. I mean, Ishido is very much looked down at by the other nobles, but yet that is also his downfall because he doesn't know how to read the room and he's trying to climb the ladder so aggressively.
Mm. And had he not tried to climb the ladder so aggressively, he might have ruled on the Council of Regents for decades, like till he died.
And there were some early on indications that he's got some good memories and you know appreciation of each other. I think he was buddies with Yabushige from war in Korea and other places. Yep. So there's. Hates bureaucratic administration. They showed that to us earlier on, so that Ishido in another world would have been buddies with Torunaga, and he would have been the hand of Torunaga or something like that, right? You know, or a very powerful region.
Yeah.
But instead, it's this clamoring for political power, and to occupy this center space of. Ultimate authority, and which makes me, I mean, I certainly don't want to be Shogun. I certainly don't want to be Taiko. So I don't know what motivates people to those ends. But it ultimately is his downfall.
Yeah.
Right.
You know.
Well, I think that maybe, you know, Torunaga, he does not come out of this looking like a great guy. You know, he from his closest friends to random village people, he goes on quite the killing spree to attain his goal. But I do think he genuinely believes that he has the best for Japan at heart. You know, that this he thinks he's doing the wrong things for the right reason.
Right. I had to headcanon the fact that maybe those heads on spikes were known criminals or, you know, people who were, you know, doing something.
No, he did random. He definitely did random.
Yeah. Nope. That was Papa who didn't come home from church that day.
Right.
But that makes him, I think that makes him a more interesting character, right? Is that he will use fear as a ruling tactic. He will be cruel when he thinks that it helps his ends. And he's not this good guy, hero, savior of Japan. Maybe the ends, you know, were great. Like he made this era of peace, this long era where Japan went through a lot of positive changes, but at what cost, right? And is that cost justified? Then again, how many lives did he save by avoiding open war?
Mm-hmm.
And the devastation that would have rolled on for decades after that, and the reconstruction of that. And I think that's to swing back around to the larger Torunaga question. I think that's the interesting thing is that real history is messy and full of compromises and half-developed policies and intentions, whereas in our fictional worlds, we can resolve things neatly and nicely, and it's very simple in a lot of ways. And I think this show had the courage to take on the historical nuances of it ain't clean. You know, there are moral compromises that have been made, and powerful leaders have to make choices that affect the individual lives of very small people relative to their power.
Right.
Hmm.
Well, speaking of smaller people, this next segment is what I like to call Unhinged Yabushige and Sad Boy Blackthorn. Yabushige is going through it.
Yeah. Oh, that desperate moment on the boat was, it was a comic relief, but also just devastating at the same time. Just,
yeah.
Humor dipped in darkness.
Oh, boy.
I thought it was interesting that they decided to play Yabashige, too, as having a little, you know, traumatic brain injury post explosion when he's chasing the carp and stuff. I didn't know exactly what that was doing for me for the story. It was definitely an interesting choice. And I don't know if it was making him more vulnerable. It was sort of because in the last episode, 9, they even show him cowering in fear when they're holed up in the storehouse. And after the explosion, you know, he's really taken down a few pegs.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And maybe the jump, you know, being concussed. And I had a friend once who had a concussion, and for a good 12 hours, he was just trapped in this loop of always asking what time it was and having to look at a newspaper to, you know, we just got a newspaper because, like, show him the date because we got tired of, it was my roommate at the time. And it was really weird because it was like he was literally a broken record. He was just stuck in this groove.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know if that's what they were going for. I wasn't quite sure with the whole crazy man Yabashige.
Yeah, I thought it was just a mental break. But I have to admit that a big part of me was like, Blackthorn, just go with him and let's do a season 2, Yabashige Takes England.
Yeah. Coming to England. Starring Eddie Murphy.
Well, they would have to get Rodriguez, though, right?
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah.
I was disappointed he didn't show back up.
I know.
Just to give Blackthorn his boyfriend back.
Yeah, you know, and I love Ishido coming up to Yabashige and talking to him and being like, I have the worst fucking vassals. Oh, yeah. Ishido is obviously very concerned about Yabashige's madness, right? It's like, mm-hmm. I wonder, honestly, I think if this were reversed and Yabashige had been, you know, hired by Torinaga to do something shady like this, I think that Torinaga would have killed him right there or had him killed in some way. And I think Ishido is just not as calculating as Torinaga.
But would Torinaga have him do something like kidnap someone like that? Because his way is more like, let's do it publicly and shame them.
No, you're right. He would never have gotten to that point.
Let's call people out. Yeah.
But you know what I mean? Is like, Torinaga mm-hmm. would not have allowed a loose end to go sail off.
Right.
Yeah, and there were
sloppy.
There were no loose ends in Yabushige's final moments. That was a clean and convincing resolve for Yabushige. I really did like the opportunity for Torinaga and Yabushige to have a final moment together, and it was a great. It worked well as an exposition dump at the same time,
right?
To clear up anything, but mm-hmm. it was a beautiful way to do it, and I appreciate it. But I just love the fact that there was even a small part of me that was hoping that Torinaga would pardon him, and it's like, oh, don't worry about it, you know, it's all good, and I'll make you a minor lord again, and we'll have some fun again, we'll get some stuff
right.
done. But nope. And it really and resolved that whole storyline in such a great way. It was a very satisfying storytelling moment.
It was.
Yeah, I was glad that Yabushige was lucid and in the end, you know, that
Agreed.
He went out very much himself. But I did also question when Torinaga said to him, you know, I keep John Blackthorn around because he makes me laugh. And I wondered if in some way Blackthorn had replaced Yabushige in Torinaga's
life.
Well, you know, we often misuse the term foil. In fiction,
mm-hmm.
foil really is a character who is stagnant, who is static, while the other character grows. The other character that starts in a similar place grows. And
it's interesting. I didn't realize that was the more truer literary definition of it.
We constantly misuse it and use it as like just a contrast character. I don't care about the misuse. But this is a true foil, I would say, is Yabushige and Blackthorn start off very much as two people for themselves. Yabushige stays that way. Blackthorn finally becomes something bigger.
Right.
That's a really good point. And to the point that Yabushige can't even see the plan. Like, he's sitting there going, Lord, I don't see it. Like, what was Crimson Sky? How did it work? And he didn't have that insight. He didn't grow. He was stuck in his flat dimensional thinking. So that's a really good point. That's really interesting.
And it's also interesting that that Blackthorn, so I guess they changed it from the book in the previous show where Blackthorn tries to commit seppuku much earlier in the story.
Yes.
I'm glad that they held this for this, you know, this last moment where Blackthorn is yelling, I was using you. I was using you. I'm the enemy. And it's like Blackthorn still doesn't realize that Toranaga's using him and it plans to for the rest of his life.
Also, wasn't enemy one of the first words that he learned?
Yes.
Right.
True. Again, those little rhyming couplets from the beginning to the end here. Mm. It was really well done. Yeah, that was really interesting because Toranaga says, if you're quite finished,
right?
Would you please, if you don't mind, you know, building me a fleet, you know, if in your spare time after you finished sob, you telling me your sob story and how you were using me. It's just, he's so much more powerful and bigger sighted than Blackthorn ever was or ever could be in that. So even though Blackthorn has this tremendous amount of growth relative to him, he's still just a piece in this larger puzzle.
Yeah. Well, we're jumping ahead a little bit. We still have other things to talk about with Blackthorn. How about the scene where Alvito is basically like, look, you were gonna die here, but Mariko saved you. And then he just weeps.
Mm. Yeah.
I was just gonna say, you know, we went into the season like, huh, is Cosmo Jarvis can he pull this? I thought characterization all the way through this final episode really was quite spot on. And he has this big puppy dog, dumb puppy dog energy about him. But it played, and his ability to spar with Alvito but while still being changed, and to see the, oh, is this where I die? It balanced so perfectly. The energy that Blackthorn has got to be experiencing in that moment. Is this where I die? This is it. How many times has he been on this precipice of almost dying?
Yep.
And have the Catholics and the Portuguese finally got my number, and nope, Mariko saves him. That was an amazing turn.
Yeah. Well, he did the grand romantic gesture of volunteering to be her second, and this is kind of her grand romantic gesture in return.
He offers her death,
her final gift,
and she offers him life.
Oh, boom! There it is.
All right.
Well, something that was in the, I want to hark back to episode 9, which I didn't realize until I watched. I was able to finish a second watch. Was that scene where after Ishido gives them the pass, you know, to leave, the way that they framed that shot and the way that they were, Mariko and Blackthorn were holding hands together, that was a wedding.
Mm.
They were married spiritually in that moment. And in that, and then, as you say, in that whole thing of in life and in death, and that's what she says to him at some point, right? Or he even says, fuck it, you know, we live and we die. Right. You know, that's their whole relationship is in that sort of Mobius loop of, you know, of life and death and twisted in that way. It's really brilliant.
I guess Blackthorn and Buntero are brother husbands now. Maybe they're married at the end.
We're just going to have a big fest with Rodriguez, Buntero.
Yeah.
It's for the boys. You know. It's for the boys.
Dream blunt rotation.
All right. That's a good note to take a break on. All right. We'll see you right after the break. And we're back. David, I hear that you also have to make a departure.
My ship is sailing. I gotta go. Gotta go chase down the black ship and reap some riches and rewards. Rodriguez is waiting for me, so I'm gonna bail.
What's the name of your country? Where are you going?
Take me with you. I just wanted to say, Alicia and John, I'm glad the three of us were finally able to podcast together about this show. I know we've been sort of, just like Blackthorn, Mariko, and Toranaga, we've all been sort of orbiting in our ways, but it's been really fun. I'm really glad we were able to cover this, and obviously we'll talk more about the season, but I just wanted to mark the moment that all three of us were on the podcast together.
It's a magnificent day.
It's happened.
We'll write poetry about it.
It happened. That's right. Anyway, I will catch you guys on the season finale, and looking forward to reading everybody's feedback. So send it in, because we want to hear from you. But otherwise, I will talk to you guys later.
All right. See you soon.
All right. Bye.
So now that David has left us, it's time for the segment Coming to Ajiro. And we are going to Ajiro. I think that's how you're supposed to say it, with the Ajiro. Yeah. Yabushige is begging Blackthorn to take him to England, but they, of course, see Erasmus is destroyed and the village is being tortured to find the culprit because Toranaga is just a swell guy.
Mm-hmm.
And we kind of talked about that already, but
yeah,
you know, Yabushige is brought before Toranaga, accused of treason and sentenced to commit seppuku. He asks for Blackthorn a second.
Yeah, interesting.
But he gets Toranaga his second.
Which, you know, I would think he would rather have, just in terms of skill with the sword, I would rather have Toranaga personally.
Well, it did take Toranaga 9 hacks.
When he was a teenager, yeah, but they don't know that. That's the thing, is only Hiramatsu knew that.
Right.
The legend is that he did it. Mm-hmm. Of course.
Right. Now, Omi is the one who sold out Yabushige. We haven't really talked about him yet this episode.
What do you think about that? I'm not surprised. I think it's kind of heartbreaking, and like he's even heartbroken himself about it at the end. He's like, well, you still named me your heir. And we get to see one more Yabushige will writing one last time for the road.
Yeah. So Omi, it's interesting because in the book, he's a lot more like ruthless. He knows that Yabushige is the one in between him and higher status. And he's basically like, how do I get this guy to dig his own grave?
Mm-hmm.
In this, he doesn't even have to do that. Yabushige just does it.
Yeah. But we see a little bit where, you know, you can tell that he was happy being, you know, the head of this province and running it basically himself. And he had his mistress and, you know, life was good.
Yeah, he had his kiku.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
He had his kiku. He had plenty of cuckoos. And he was having a great time.
Yeah, and life was good for him. And then his uncle comes back in and messes it all up. And of course, most of it is actually Toranaga's fault, but I can see why he was always kind of looking side-eye at his uncle, and then he sees an opportunity for personal advancement.
Right. Well, someone else is back in Ajiro. Fuji, of course, has been taking care of Blackthorn's home that he hasn't been to seemingly in months.
Mm-hmm. Her last
It's been 6 months, right? Because she's been relieved of her service.
Right. I guess, 6 months in total.
Yeah. They have no translator. And like, I love that they use the lack of a translator to sort of emphasize the hole that Mariko left behind.
Right. Yeah, I loved just the quiet moment there, because it's true they didn't have anyone to translate their literal words, but they also didn't need it at that moment. They knew that they were both feeling the same thing.
Right.
And they just look at where she would be sitting.
And she was totally, totally in the know about the way that Mariko and Blackthorn felt about each other.
I mean, she literally lived in the same house.
Yeah. Yeah. Three's company too.
Yeah, no, I think they were really created a nice little family there for a moment. You know, it's only 6 months maximum, minus time traveling to Osaka. But that was probably, for those who live, that's going to be a period that they think back on forever.
Yeah, for sure. What do you think about her keeping her family's ashes against custom?
Well, I feel like I was one of the people, a few people expressed this on the Discord, who was kind of at first like, are they being disrespectful with the way they dispose of the ashes, disrespectful to Japanese customs? But then it was such a beautiful moment, I didn't care. And actually, when you put it this way, that she's already keeping the ashes against custom, it's like, well, why not just go a different way with it? She obviously wasn't feeling good about what she thought she was supposed to do with them. So let's do something that gives her peace.
Yeah, you know, it's an interesting thing. You know, we say, are they being disrespectful to Japanese custom? But Fuji is an individual. And does mm-hmm. she want to follow Japanese custom, right? I mean, not all of us who were raised Catholic stay Catholic. And, you know, all these different aspects of making her a multi-layered character, I think really add to the realism of the show.
Absolutely. I mean, that's what's so remarkable about the show, is that every character has all these layers, they really built out what is the three hearts of each character and show them in conflict with each other, with themselves.
Yeah, and it's interesting because since Fuji is a really minor character in the book, and she's still pretty minor in the show, but she feels so much bigger than her screen time.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, it's touching. Nate, our resident historian, he was sharing a Japanese article about the actress, and that she's kind of overwhelmed by all the attention and love that her character is getting and all the memes.
Oh, that's nice.
Yeah.
That's so nice. But yeah, I mean, I think that I see where people are coming from on, are they disrespecting Japanese customs? But I don't know. I think the character moment works, like you said, and I don't know if we need to have Fuji want to follow the Japanese custom. Like maybe that was really meaningful for her. She was in a weird situation to begin with, right? She mm-hmm. was recently widowed and childless, and she is sent to become the consort of a newly minted foreign samurai who didn't even speak her language. And then that guy has an affair with one of her buddies. And it's just such a weird situation overall. And I think that her situation is so different and out of the norm for what she was raised to do that I wouldn't blame her for wanting to try something new.
Yeah, absolutely. And we get to finally see her have the ability to say no and take some control of her own fate.
Right. Yeah, I want to talk about that too. Blackthorn, is he just like, I need somebody I know?
I think so. I mean, yeah, he's lost so much in such a short time. Right. Well, especially with Mariko, but yeah, I can imagine he feels especially isolated now. He has to bond with Buntaro, of all people.
They're besties. I want a sitcom.
Yeah. A buddy comedy.
Buntaro and Blackthorn as roommates.
Yeah. Just going, get horsing around the land, taking care of petty crime in different villages in their province.
Yeah. And Blackthorn is just there to fling English or Portuguese curses at people and not right. have them know what he's saying.
Don't translate that. I love that. When he said that to when the samurai outs himself.
That was
himself.
Really good later. Yeah. And she does help Blackthorn. Fuji helps Blackthorn set up the meeting with Torunaga, right? Mm-hmm. I wonder how did she translate that? How did she translate?
I thought about that
too. Did she just kind of, you know, write a message? But yeah, this is a little confusing to me, is how did he prepare his statement?
Oh, how did he learn what he wanted to say?
Yeah. He's like, I prepared a statement. How did he do that? Like, it would make sense if Mariko was still there, or if he knew that he could go to Maranji.
Right. But how did he get, obviously he must have turned to Fuji, but how would she know what he was trying to say? Yeah. Good question.
Little plot hole.
Maybe he drew pictograms.
Yeah, maybe. Maybe I want a full scene. I want like a 10-minute scene of him just miming to her what he wants to say. And her like making facial expressions reacting to his dancing.
Or finding out that actually he was intending to say something completely different.
Yeah, yeah. All right. Blackthorn and Torunaga, sort of the, I would say, the character development climax of this series. Because, you know, we spent a lot of time. The book is really the Blackthorn story. Mm-hmm. The show, I would say, is more of the Torunaga Mariko story.
Right.
And this episode kind of brought us back to the Blackthorn story to bring it full circle. He kind of came back out of the background. And this felt like finally the climax of his arc.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, and I think they pace that out well. And again, haven't read the book, but it seems like the changes that they've made the way they're described to me, at least, I think that they were smart changes, especially in this regard.
They definitely do the attempted seppuku too early in the book, because it makes an emotional climax happen really early.
Mm-hmm.
And then can you just do it again at the end and have it have the same impact? I think it has more of an impact if this is the first time.
Right, especially because he's been so like, oh, this culture that, you know, just kills my gardener for throwing away my rotting pheasant.
Right, right.
Also, full circle.
Yeah, I want to talk about, well, there's been a lot of chatter in the Discord about overuse of the word seppuku.
Okay.
And it seems like people are upset, and I could be misunderstanding, but I think people are upset that people are, that viewers are using the word seppuku with what Blackthorn was doing.
But was it, I mean, was it not, because he was going to gut himself, right? But he didn't have, yeah. he didn't even name a second. I was like, what are you doing, dude?
I think, to me, it's not traditional seppuku.
Right.
But I would say he is trying to do it. He's
right.
It, in his limited understanding of it, it is attempted seppuku.
Mm-hmm.
Because
that's his goal.
I mean, he's seen it done. He's seen Mariko prepare, and he's like, I'm gonna do the same things. He's gonna lay his dagger down in front of him, and so I do think that he was trying to mimic what he saw.
But also the way Mariko was doing it, it was apparently not the way that women typically did it, and the character Mariko was based on did end her life in that way, or she was killed by her servants.
Right. Yeah. That's like a whole thing too. We don't have time for that can of worms. But yeah, I mean, I understand the whole idea of like, let's not call all suicide seppuku.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that Blackthorn was at least trying to.
Yeah, it was his intention.
Play seppuku. Yeah.
Yeah.
And he was going to do it. I really do think if Torunaga had not stopped him there, he would have done it.
But the fact he didn't even name a second shows how this is a character who doesn't think all the steps ahead like Torunaga does, for instance.
Right. It's almost like when he speaks Japanese, does he speak Japanese? Like, can we say he's speaking Japanese if he's speaking broken Japanese? I think so. He's just doing it poorly.
Yeah, I mean, I think as long as it's, when it's broken Japanese and it's his own thoughts, then it is. It reminds me of, there's a lot of discussion in the psychology community over whether animals, for instance, great apes, are able to learn, for instance, sign language. Mm-hmm. And then the question becomes, are they actually signing things out of their own thoughts, or have they just learned to mimic those around them?
Maybe we should ask them.
Well, exactly. I mean, I think, yeah, there's compelling arguments to both sides for that in the animal case. But in this case, I think the question comes down to the same, especially considering they had Blackthorn. They show he's gifted with European languages. Of course, Japanese is going to be a completely different linguistic beast. But yeah. How much does he know by the end? Like, for instance, when in episode 9, when they were in Osaka and he and Yabushige are trying to communicate to each other, how much actual understanding was there of between them and of what he was acting out in court, or, you know, versus just mimicking to get through this experience.
Honto. Yeah. I agree with that. I think that that's a good distinction there that you've made. So another aspect to this whole scene is Miraji being a secret samurai who speaks fluent Portuguese and has just been like the master of everything the whole time.
Right. Which we had a glimpse of as an audience, but I guess I didn't think about the fact that he might secretly speak Portuguese.
Yeah, well, he did help him a little bit, right? Like, he knew a few phrases.
Mm-hmm.
But he was pretending to be like not that great at it.
Right. But we knew he was a samurai, but we didn't know that he also had linguistic skills.
Right.
So it is interesting. I mean, I guess obviously Torinaga wanted to keep his role and his background secrets so that he could be the little spy in the village. But it's interesting that Torinaga asked Mariko to be the translator, the interpreter.
Yeah. There's also the whole scene where Torinaga and Blackthorn are arguing and through Miraji, but Blackthorn just starts speaking in, I think, English, maybe Portuguese, and he's just yelling at him. He's just like, I'm feeding you shit. I fed you shit.
Yeah.
And he's mimicking it too. He's miming it.
Yeah.
Just kind of is just like, I'm going to make you understand without any kind of barrier. I'm going to look you in the eye.
Mm-hmm.
And that felt like an important moment for him too.
Yeah. See, I wish I knew whether he was speaking English or Portuguese in that moment, because to me that communicates different things. Like, if he's speaking English, it's really just him going to his most unhinged emotional id place. And if he's speaking Portuguese, he's still expecting, you know, the interpreter present to understand this and be able to repeat it back later.
Right.
So that's one of the cases where I'm like, it was just a little sloppy the way the European languages were handled, which is so unlike the rest of the show.
To me, it was few and far between. I mean, I think the problem is if you introduce speaking different languages at different times, then you have to address, are you going to have Mariko and Blackthorn speak Latin at certain times? Because that's something that happens in the books.
Yeah, well, I can understand dropping Portuguese. Latin. Yeah.
There's just like a lot of tricky moments, I think. You know, are you going to have Blackthorn now speak Dutch when he speaks to his crewmates?
Yes, I very much want to hear Cosmo Jarvis speak Dutch.
I don't think Cosmo Jarvis wants to hear Cosmo Jarvis speak Dutch. That's the problem.
I mean, but that's the thing, is he is an Englishman, so he's supposed to have an accent when he speaks these other languages. True. It's not like he's supposed to sound like a native.
Right.
But anyway, I'll stop harping on that.
No, fair enough. And I think the show made certain decisions at different points. Like I mentioned, when you have Father Alvito talking to Torinaga, and Torinaga's like, he's not worthy to speak our tongue. I'm like, okay, they definitely just wanted this actor to be able to full act and not think about language in the scene. Like, that's why they did that.
No, it's true. And I do like the Cosmo Jarvis casting. I don't know how good he is personally with languages.
Yeah, maybe they handed him a script with some Portuguese in it, and they were like, yeah, we can't do this. We love you as Blackthorn, but we're not making you speak Portuguese.
Yeah, that's fair.
I don't know. I used to do a lot of singing in like choirs and jazz stuff. And I had this jazz piece I had to sing once called Bananeira, and it was Portuguese. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, why do none of the syllables look like they sound? It's so different from Spanish in the pronunciation.
It is.
I understand why. Like, Portuguese is a hard language to learn if you speak English.
Yeah. No, I used to date a guy named João, and I'm sure the Portuguese speakers are cringing, but he was constantly trying to get me to say the vowel right, but they have some interesting sounds.
Yeah. So Blackthorn has given up his Western ambitions, right? Mm-hmm. I would say. Which is funny because later Torinaga mentions his whole idea of like, oh, your war is stupid. Your war is small unless I win. Right.
Right.
And so Torunaga, I think, believes in Blackthorn's war more than he does now.
Yeah, I mean, I think Blackthorn is still an individualist in the end. And if it's like, okay, here are your options. You can go chasing glory back in, you know, Europe and maybe with your ties to Japan or whatever. But that's going to be a fraught life full of battles. And this life, yeah, there's going to be some battles, but you're already in a comfortable position. You live in a beautiful place. You're just going to build ships for the rest of your days, basically. Like, I can see why leave that life
and
to go back to war.
He's got it made, right? Like, he has a great salary. He's got a fief. He's got, you know, he has servants for everything. I mean, he's living a life of luxury, really. Like, in England, he probably never would have reached this level of riches.
And this is early days in the 80 Years' War as well. So I can imagine maybe things looked a little hopeless because this war, as the name implies, went on for 80 freaking years. So,
yeah. And can we just pour one out for Blackthorn's European family, though? Because they are just screwed at this point.
I hope that they are well enough off from his. He was obviously not from the poorest of positions, considering his position on the boat when they arrived. Mm-hmm. So I hope they're well enough off. She gets to declare herself a widow and live life on her own terms, as often widows were only able to do.
Well, I'm not sure that I believe in 16th, 17th century public welfare. I don't know if that was a thing, but let's hope that the public was good to them.
Yeah. I mean, I'm hoping that they just had enough money, family money, things like that.
Yeah.
And that this gives her a little more freedom to find someone who's not going to keep running away to anyone else but your family life.
Yeah, it's funny. Like, he in the book, he has a lot of internal monologue where he's like, how am I going to go back to my smelly wife? You know, like everybody smells back there.
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to go back there? Everyone's so filthy. I think he even thinks, he's like, could I convince her to start bathing like the Japanese? It's just funny. All right. So let's go to Yabushige's seppuku. And I noticed David loves to talk about his rhyming couplets, but there was a big rhyming couplet here, which is that in episode 3 in the opening, Yabushige is writing his will. And he thinks he's going to die because Torunaga gives him this beautiful sunrise, right? He invites him up to see the sunrise. And he's like, thanks for the sunrise. Let's get on with it.
Mm.
Now it's sunset and he's going to die with Torunaga.
Right. I mean, and it's funny because that was the end of the sunrise was at the beginning of what we see of their story together. And the sunset is the close of
right.
it.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's pretty beautiful.
Yeah, I love just the fact that he is most himself in this moment here too, you know, with his crappy poem and cockiness about it as you wrote here. But also when he looks back over his shoulder at the last moment, like, you're not really going to do it, huh? He sure does do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yabushige is not making it out of there.
Mm-mm.
He needs to know what's coming next, though. He's like, fine, kill me, but before I die, can you just tell me what's coming next?
I would be.
And Torunaga does it. Yeah. The only thing he denies him is a confirmation of his secret heart, right?
Right. I mean, I can imagine from Torunaga's perspective, like, he's lost pretty much anyone he can speak to openly, and this is his last chance to just gloat a little bit. Like, I did the thing. Look, I did the thing. I can't be this open about it with anyone else. So why not you? Because I know you're not going to tell anyone.
Yeah. And so in the book, this is an internal monologue. This is, you know, his thoughts. This is Torunaga's thoughts. So I thought this was a really brilliant way to allow an exposition dump that made sense.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, I mean, great idea. Great idea. Tell it to a dying man.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And, I have in apparently, so Yabushige, he's based on the real life Honda Masanobu. And in the real life, this Masanobu Honda, he basically died of alcoholism. You know, he just drank himself to death because of his guilt and whatever over his maneuvering. I think that this is a more satisfying end. What do you think?
For sure.
Kind of the alcoholism death is more tragic, even sadder.
Yeah, it is. It is. There's actually, that's interesting you say that, because in the book, there's an early scene where I think Miraji is massaging Yabushige, who's like Yabu in the book. Mm-hmm. But he feels his liver. He's like, oh, those kidneys and the liver are shot. Like, he's going to be dead in a few years. Like, he could feel like alcohol sickness, basically.
I wonder if that's, you know, David was asking about his break and the chasing the carp in the pond. I wonder if he was just drinking himself too hard at that moment.
Yeah. Well, also cirrhosis can cause, you know, hallucinations and whatnot.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. All right. So we've got a couple more things to talk about. I just want to talk about Torunaga's plan. I mean, we talked about the real history, but was there a backup plan if Ochiba did not bail him out?
You mean because it got to the battlefield before?
Yeah. Yeah. Like, was there a backup plan? Well, I don't think he would have ever let it get to the battlefield, right? But, you know, Torunaga clearly has a plan at the beginning of the episode before he ever gets Ochiba's letter. But I think this was plan A, was convince Ochiba to ally. But what was plan B is my question.
I mean, I think his maneuver with Mariko in Osaka was just to get as many people as possible to want to jump ship and be on his side, because they were afraid of Ishiro caging them, basically, of them being.
They were like, this guy straight up sucks, Ishiro.
Yeah. Yeah, Torunaga makes himself look like the better person also, because people are upset about Mariko.
Yeah.
And he knew that. He was willing to sacrifice her, knowing the effect that it would have on people.
Especially, I mean, this is just something that happens, maybe not with his plan, but the way that she delivers such a beautiful poem in front of all the nobles and, you know, like the day before she dies.
Right.
And it's really sad. And I think people are really like, this is a young woman who should have had a long life ahead of her. And now she's gone. All because Ishiro failed to keep a safe realm.
But I guess she was also quite famous. So it's like, in a way, if there was a saintly Lady Gaga who suddenly got killed, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So Torunaga absolutely wanted to be shogun the whole time, right?
Yes. I think he almost admits as much to Yabushige.
Yeah. And the whole time he's like, oh, I don't want to be shogun. No, yeah. No.
Liar,
and
I think it's actually kimono on fire.
It's honestly, so I actually tried to do some research on this and I couldn't find anything, but in Western culture, the reluctant leader, the reluctant hero, is such a trope, you know, going back as far as Moses.
Right.
You know, not wanting to lead the Hebrews out of Egypt. And I was trying to find if this was a similar trope in Eastern cultures, especially Japan.
Mm-hmm.
But I couldn't find a single reference. And I looked everywhere on the internet. I spent like an hour looking for stuff, and I couldn't find anything. So if anyone has any thoughts on that, maybe I'll ask Nate next week. But I'm really curious, because Torunaga publicly is the reluctant leader, but he's not in his secret heart. And that's what makes him, I think, a more interesting character than we're used to.
Absolutely. Yeah, because this is a more realistic, but also we learn that Torunaga understands the power of legend, of stories being presented in certain ways, like the beheading of his youth.
Right, right. So he's got visions of an era of peace. He's just taken away Ishido's allies and made him lose before the first battle. Yeah, I mean, what a crazy plan that worked.
Yeah. I mean, it's convenient. A lot of elements like that in the story are convenient, but I don't mind it, because it's So it's like, you know, he's not controlling the wind, but he's composing the music that he makes all the different players dance to.
Yeah. He's certainly, like I said, he's certainly redirecting it in certain points.
Right.
And he kept Blackthorn because he made him laugh. But I think by the end, he definitely learned from him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that whole quote of the battle doesn't matter unless I win. I mean, he basically had, everybody was telling him the whole time, this is a hopeless battle against Ishido and the Regents. And he's like, unless I win. And he did win.
Yeah. But it's also funny because it's kind of like the whole pheasant thing with the, you know, letting it rot and letting the maggots eat away and tenderize the meat. That's basically was how Toranaga handled this entire situation. So he was like, how do I let this regency rot from within and send in little maggots like Marco, not to ever call her a maggot, but you know what I mean? To nibble, to nibble at the flesh and soften it up so that it just sloughs off itself.
Right. I sent a woman to do what an army never could.
Right.
Genius. And the whole time, I love the way the show subverted our expectations, because the whole time we're like, oh, we're going to use cannons and we're going to storm Osaka and it's going to be an amazing battle. And we're thinking Crimson Sky is the name of the episode. I remember I listened to your podcast with David on episode 8.
Mm-hmm.
And...
And yeah, we were podcast, expecting.
You guys were like, oh, next episode's Crimson Sky. It's going to be a crazy battle.
But and, it was a crazy battle.
Yeah.
Just not the way we expected. Not with armies, but with Mariko and her attendants and power of the wills.
The way that, and I don't want to relitigate the whole episode 9, but the way that Anna Sawai raises her voice to a higher pitch that's so cutting, it feels like a knife being driven into Ishido. And it was just such a good episode. I think that's the episode of the season.
I think so, too. I agree. I think that this finale was perfect in wrapping things up in a way that felt natural and appropriate and tied all the pieces together and gave a satisfying ending. But it is still the denouement.
Yeah. So we'll... Toranaga keep destroying Blackthorn ships. Do we think that's going to happen? Because he's like, maybe I'll have to destroy it again.
I mean, I think at some point it might be handy for him to have a fleet of his own. He might, that might be something that he would actually like to have.
Oh, no, we definitely need a fire department over here, Blackthorn. I'm really sorry your third ship got burned down.
Yeah, it's just the lightning here. It's crazy.
Yeah. All right, so getting the ship. This was a fun little way to end the episode. Directing everyone with the help of Muraji, but I think he's speaking better Japanese now than he has been.
Yeah, finally, yeah.
You brought up the don't translate that when he's cursing at them.
Yeah, this, which I guess means that he's cursing in Portuguese. You would think he'd be cursing in English.
Yeah, yeah. Fair enough. Maybe it's just like he doesn't want to switch back and forth so often.
Right. Maybe he likes that. He's like, okay, Muraji, you and I have this special bond where you get my jokes because nobody else does.
So he can't get the ship out until Buntaro joins his new bestie. Why is Buntaro the guy who can just pull a ship out? I feel like nobody else even needed to be on the ropes, right? Like Buntaro would have just walked up and been like, yeah, I got this.
He's a samurai of legend. What can I say?
Yeah. I can't believe that this guy survived the season.
Yeah. I was kind of surprised by that too. And I was surprised that he landed in a relatively, I mean, he's been taken down so many pegs, especially with Mariko and his father and everything. But, he landed in a surprisingly okay place. Like, he can just live his life. He's got legendary status. He could definitely marry again as he wants.
Yeah. Well, and also his son is of the Akechi line. Right. And I think that will give him some good status too, because that was a really high line.
Yeah, his son was completely brainwashed by the Ishido cult. I wonder what their relationship is, if anything, after this.
I don't think that Bruntero has spent a day parenting.
No.
I think he's probably said 10 words to that kid.
Yeah. But he's still going to give him all of his land and titles or whatever.
Yeah. They'll talk when he's an adult, right? Like, that seems to be the Bruntero style of parenting is, yeah, I'll talk to my kids when they're adults.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And Blackthorn, of course, shares one more look with Torunaga before we cut to black.
Yeah. It's really the love story between the two of them.
No.
And Japan.
It's Rodriguez.
Rodriguez and Blackthorn. I know. Where was Rodriguez? As soon as when they were like, oh, look, the ship is back. It was that in episode 9. I was really hoping Rodriguez was going to be on board. Does he come back at the end in the book?
I didn't finish the book.
Okay.
I'm almost done. I did read the wiki of what happens at the end of the book because I just wanted to make sure that, like, right. I knew some of the differences.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't look it up until after I watched the final episode because I didn't want that spoiled for me.
Right.
All right. So let's talk about our favorite moments before we head out of here. You want to do the first one?
Sure. So, I mean, I guess it was just Yabu writing his final will and then dying the way that he lived, you know, that look back over the shoulder, like I said, in his kick-ass poem. Gonna get it tattooed.
I like that. My first one was him, you know, Yabushige is great. Just Yabushige shouting, teach me to dive!
Yeah.
Blackthorn. Oh, just unhinged.
Desperation.
Unhinged.
Oh, pure desperation.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that he comes back from that and then is so, you know, he does his duty, quote unquote. He's composed in the end. He goes through with it.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. He does. I think he understands. He's like, all right, I played the Game of Thrones and I lost, so I die.
Right. Right. I mean, I think he's obviously always thinking about his legacy with that rewriting of the will all the time. And he wants to go out with honor.
Yep. What was your second favorite moment?
Yeah, it was definitely realizing that the Blackthorn flashback was not actually how his story was going to end, because that was, to me, just kind of like going to be the most depressing part of all.
Yeah.
Those little English brats calling the people we've fallen in love with savages. It was like, oh no.
Yeah. I was thinking, like, did he not raise his kids better?
I know.
To raise their kids better.
Yeah. Did he raise his kids at all, or was he just in Japan?
Oh, right. Yeah. Fair enough. Do you think he starts another family? Does he get another family in Japan, or does he ever sail his family over?
I highly doubt that he would ever sail his family over, because first he would have to disinfect his wife and children.
just hose them down when they get there.
But I think I could see in the story him settling down, because I think it would also, if he's keeping this status as a nobleman, it's probably somewhat expected of him.
Right.
Yeah. And what was your second?
Mine was Blackthorn starting to just break down in tears when he learns that Mariko saved him, and just this mutual respect between him and Alvito. You know, the kind of this whole scene where, you know, he goes, I prayed to God, but not your God or my God, just God, which feels like a really modern sentiment. And it did take me out a little bit, but I really liked that sentiment between them because it just felt really emotional.
Yeah. The moment where I got most emotional was when Torunaga was talking about Mariko's poetry. And, you know, he repeated the line about her words in the bonfire, and just, you know, how brightly that bonfire burns because of all these words she left behind. And yeah, again, that reminded me that this is based on a real person. And a lot of the poetry, as you said, was actually poetry written by Hosokawa Gracia. So that's just a beautiful thing to remember, that this woman did sacrifice herself in real life. But centuries later, we are still talking about that sacrifice. So it wasn't for nothing, I suppose.
Right. Yeah. I mean, she had an insane influence on Japanese history.
Right. Yeah. Absolutely. And your final favorite moment?
the lack of battles. It's actually the absence of something that was my favorite, which was that there was no big, you know, physical battle in this whole season. It was just verbal battles. It was battles of character to character. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. It felt real and it felt fresh.
Right. Absolutely. More focused on the human players rather than the machines of war.
Definitely. Well, as we mentioned in the intro, we're going to save all our feedback for the season wrap-up podcast, which will be out in about a week. But you can always send that feedback into shogun@thelorehounds.com, or you can go to thelorehounds.com, go to the contact page, and you'll be able to leave us a voicemail or a contact form entry. You can also send us a message on Discord, you know, go into the Shogun channel, tag us, say, I want this to be feedback, and we'll include that as well. And Alicia, you'll be back for the season wrap up. Is that right?
Absolutely. And in the meantime, you can check out going live around the same time as this is the episodes 1-3 breakdown of Beacon 23 season 2 on Wool Shift Dust.
Nice transition. So Wool Shift Dust, you're back with Beacon 23. And I'm sorry about doing my impression of you saying that. I know Hugh Howey.
But... like I said, I should stop making that my catchphrase.
It made David laugh, at least. But yeah, so you've got a lot going on your feed. You've got, do you have some Dune stuff going on too?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the Dune stuff is still in the works, although I have to be honest, it's slightly paused because I'm prepping for this to launch the Star Wars Canon Timeline podcast.
Right, right. I wasn't sure how much I was allowed to say about that yet, so I was letting you do it.
Yeah, no, that's going to be kicking off probably in the next week or so. We're going to put the first episodes live, just a little bit of background information leading up to The Acolyte.
Cool. And for more science fiction goodness, we have our new feed, Radioactive Ramblings, with Aaron and Chase covering the Fallout show on Amazon. Are you watching Fallout, Alicia?
Yes, I've watched the entire season now. It was great. Yeah, it's another one of my favorite shows of the year.
Awesome. Yeah, I've watched the first two episodes and it's good. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so they have podcasts out for everything so far. Their full season is out now. You can listen to it. And I know they're going to be covering some other stuff soon, but I'm not sure their concrete plans, so stay posted for that.
Yeah, there was whisperings of Invincible and Elden Rings, which both turned my head.
A lot of stuff going on that feed. All right. Rings and Rituals is still going strong. One podcast every 2 weeks covering season one of the Rings of Power on Prime. They are not just doing a standard breakdown, though. They are looking at it through the lens of ritual, through the bigger Tolkien legendarium, and looking at ritual in our daily lives. So, you know, you can check out a bunch of the episodes right now. You may have heard a little ad for it at the beginning of this podcast if you're on the public feed. And I hope you'll enjoy it because it's a lovely morning podcast. I think it's great with a cup of coffee or tea.
I listen to a lot of podcasts while biking. Oh. And it's just, nice to be able, it's a calming one. So I look around, I see the canals, and I think about the role ritual plays in my life.
Mm. Do you ever see Rebecca's boyfriend in Ted Lasso?
Oh.
Did you bike around Amsterdam?
Yeah, I pass his boat every day.
Okay, good. Good, good. Properly Howard is really going strong right now with the season of Felonies and Fugazis. It's a crime-themed season where they are rating a bunch of movies on a scale of better, worse, or on par with the average Ron Howard movie, which is just a fun premise, and I always enjoy it. But they're doing Point Break, Shakedown, Tango and Cash, Pulp Fiction, Gross Point Blank, and Rocky. It's really funny. I would recommend you check it out. Even if you're not watching the movies, it's fun to listen.
Well, yeah, it's most of those are movies that I watched a long time ago, and then it's fun to get a little reminder. And then some of them are ones I've never heard of, which are kind of often the funniest episodes.
Yeah, because they describe these movies in ways that you're like, how is this a real movie? And of course, stay tuned for our coverage with Properly Harrowed jointly on Severance whenever that comes out. But it seems like they wrap filming, so it's going to come out sometime this year.
And you and I need to talk about Doctor Who.
Doctor Who is coming.
Some talk of Star Wars catch up.
I know. Yeah, we got you and I have some scheduling to do. So we're going to do something on The Bad Batch. We're going to do some coverage of Doctor Who, but we got to be really careful about how much we commit to because there's a lot coming in June.
Yeah.
On the main Lorehounds feed, we are going to be covering House of the Dragon season one and then season two. So we're going to do five podcasts, each covering two episodes of season one. And then that will lead right up to season two, where we'll do full coverage of every single episode, just like we did Shogun. Probably even more detailed, because we'll probably do a scene-by-scene recap of it.
Cool.
And I'm working on a show guide, so if you want access to that, subscribe to the Patreon. We offered it for Shogun too. It's a character guide. There will be episode guides. We're working on a dragon guide and a geography guide, so we got plenty of material there. I mean, that world is so full with lore. There's just so much I could put in there. We also are covering the Silmarillion still every month, covering Earthsea until we finish that. And Silmarillion Stories is now a rotating guest show. I think, Alicia, you might be on a future episode.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, of course, join us next week for our season wrap-up of Shogun featuring Nate, who you may recognize from the Discord, Nathan Ledbetter, a PhD candidate and member of the East Asian Studies faculty at Princeton.
Just absolutely focused on this period. He's the perfect person to talk to about this.
Yeah, he's brilliant. He always has such crazy details on the Discord, so I can't wait to talk to him in person. All right. Quick thank yous. If you want to access early and ad-free episodes, you can go to Supercast or Patreon and subscribe for as little as $3 a month. You can find all those links in the show notes. And like I said, you can get the show guides too for Shogun and House of the Dragon. We did one for True Detective. So we're going strong on those. Our Discord server boosters, who help us get a few extra features on the Discord, are Opus and the Machine Gnarls, Aaron K, Tiller the Thriller, Dork of the Ninjas, and Dude71. Thank you to all of you. And our Patreon lore masters, our top tier patrons and Supercast subscribers. I got to start saying that better. Who get a shout out every episode are Samartian, Mark H, Michael G, Michelle E, David W, Brian P, Nick W, SC, Peter OH, Bettina W, Adam S, Nancy M, Duve71, Brian8063, Frederick H, Sarah L, Gareth C, Eric F, Matthew M, Sarah M, DJ Miwa, Andra B, Kwang Yu, Deadeye Jedi Bob, Nathan T, Alex V, Aaron T, Sub-Zero, Aaron K, Dally V21, Mothership 61, Gnarls, and Adrian. All right. Thank you, everyone, for all your support, all our patrons, all our listeners. Thank you, Alicia, for being here and subbing for David while he's traveling.
Thank you for having me again.
See you next week. The Lorehounds podcast is produced and published by The Lorehounds. You can send questions and feedback and voicemails at thelorehounds.com/contact. Get early and ad-free access to all Lorehounds podcasts at patreon.com/thelorehounds. Any opinions stated are ours personally and do not reflect the opinion of or belong to any employers or other entities. Thanks for listening.
Hey, Mark, I was listening to Paramore the other day, and it really made me think about the amygdala and the limbic system.
You just made those words up, didn't you?
What, Paramore?
We're the Nevermind the Music podcast, where one musician
and one psychologist
talk songwriting and the mind, one song at a time.
We'll hear everything from Green Day and Outkast
to Stevie Wonder and Dua Lipa.
And we mostly try to stay on topic.
Except for when we don't want to.
Nevermind the Music, wherever you get your podcasts.